Dr. Carroll, various people such as Bill Gates and including you have warned about the threat of a new pandemic long time ago. Is it right to assume that you're not surprised about the outbreak of coronavirus?
The outbreak of this virus doesn't come as a surprise, certainly to us who have worked in this field over the last two decades. Its emergence, where it emerged from, and all of the different features around it, how it spread as a respiratory virus, none of that is a surprise at all, no.
Why?
You know, the emergence of viruses like this COVID-19 virus, it's part of a natural pattern. All of the viruses that we've dealt with in the past, the ones that are more epidemic, all of those viruses have pre-existed and circulating in wildlife animals. So we know that there is a deep reservoir in the wildlife animal population, viruses like the COVID-19 virus, and they do periodically spill over. That is, they jump from wildlife species into people, either directly. And as we look at influenzas moving from wild fowl into poultry indirectly and then jumping on into human populations, either by way of poultry or swine. So these are normal events. The 21st century, however, is not a normal century. And that's largely because we're looking at an increased frequency and an intensity of these spillover events. And that's largely driven by human population growth. It's hard for us to conceive that the world we live in today is not typical of the world that our ancestors lived in. If we were talking about the 1918 pandemic, we would have been talking about a global population then of about 1.8 billion people. And just reflect on that for a moment. As a species, Homo sapiens, it took us almost the entirety of our existence, 300,000 years before we hit the 1 billion mark. And in the space of one century between 1918 and today, we've added an additional 6 billion people onto this planet. You can't have that explosive growth in human population without significantly disrupting the ecosystems around us. One aspect of that disruptive effect is intensified interactions between us and wildlife populations as we expand our footprint into wildlife domain. So this COVID-19 virus is part of a larger pattern. And quite frankly, it's not the last of a new viral threat. We will see more of these in the future as we go forward.
These have been a lot of aspects that you've mentioned. So let us go a little more into detail in a bit. For example, talking about the spillover events, just sticking with coronavirus for a little longer. What is most dangerous about it, according to you?
Well, the most dangerous thing about the virus actually isn't the virus. It's the way we're reacting to it. I think what you've seen is around the world a chaotic response, and certainly my country, the United States, is typical of that. That to me is the most frightening piece, that we've had a fragmented, non-unified response to this virus, country by country, and even within countries. And this is totally a surprise to me because we have had 20 years of deep experience with these viruses. And we understand in the absence of a vaccine or a pharmaceutical treatment, just how important personal hygiene and social distancing is and how to execute it. Over the last two decades, collectively, we've gone through exercises to speak to what preparedness needs to look like.
What does it need to look like?
Well, how it's a whole of society event, how it needs to be coordinated across borders, borders both in terms of states, but also in terms of countries. Virus does not recognize the geopolitical boundaries that we insert in our lives. I suspect what we're looking at is a consequence of the fragmentation over the last 4 years, and with the rise of populism here in the United States and elsewhere in the world, we found that those traditional global networks have been severely undermined. So when you ask me what surprises me about the virus, in a curious way, it's not the virus's behavior, it's our behavior.
Does it also mean that science has been neglected and funding science by different countries?
Well, I think what you've seen is the rise of political rhetoric, which has been dismissive of scientific evidence. Again, in my own country, we've seen, even as this virus was clearly identified by early January of this year as a global threat, and the scientific information that was coming out was rapidly helping us understand the specifics about this virus. We saw and continue to see global political leaders be dismissive of what the scientific evidence was telling us. So this devaluation of science is really an alarming trend, and we're seeing it play itself out in a very unfortunate way as we try to mobilize effective responses to this particular threat.
So let's talk about science and your scientific work, nature and the threats that are out there, viruses that are looming inside animals and then potentially being transmitted to humans. How big is this threat?
Well, in work that I've been involved in over the last decade, we've been able to begin actually quantifying to when we talk about this large viral dark matter circulating in wildlife that might pose a future threat to humans. We're estimating there are about 1.7 million different viruses across 25 viral families. And of those, we're estimating about 600,000 have the potential to infect people. Now, only a small percentage of that, when we talk about infection, doesn't necessarily mean to serious illness. So it's some smaller subset. But understanding that's the volume of potential risk that we're likely to face over the course of this century becomes even that much more critical, that we can begin developing a much deeper and bigger database to quantify and characterize and understand that vast pool of viruses, which will, over the course of the century, begin spilling over more and more and causing even more significant problems.
Is this being underestimated currently?
Well, it's being certainly underestimated and underattended to. But that's largely because I think as a global society, whether you're sitting in Germany or the United States, or even if you're in India or in Thailand, we tend as a global community to undervalue risk. That is, we tend to put our investment and our money against those things that we know and are actively posing a threat to us. We didn't pay attention to COVID-19 virus when it was circulating in wildlife. Once it began circulating in humans, we're now beginning to respond to it. So one of the real challenges we have is changing the investment paradigm from governments to foundations to the private sector, and really invest in beginning to understand the details of that risk before it spills over. Know the virus before it knows us, if you will. But that's investing in the unknown, that's investing in what might happen. And we're terrible at investing in those things that aren't, if you will, kicking our door in. If you look at the total amount of money that's been invested over the years in shining a light on this unknown, resources have been negligible. When I was with the U.S. Agency for International Development, I oversaw a program, PREDICT, which, quite frankly, was the single largest, most cohesive investment of this type. And we were investing $20 million a year. For issue of this significance, that level of funding is a gross underinvestment. And as we go forward, what we need to do is to build a global partnership and make it a global joint venture that will allow us to be better prepared for future events.
A few moments ago, you have mentioned or hinted that we are penetrating nature too much and therefore increasing the risk of those spillover events. How can we reduce this activity?
Well, first off, I mean, you know, as I said, the big driver is human population, and human population impacts on the ecosystems in a variety of ways. One, we're increasing our settlement patterns. Two, agriculture to feed the people, we're having a hugely disruptive effect on ecosystems towards that end. And then thirdly, the other major disruptor is penetrating wildlife areas in search of valuable minerals and natural wealth to drive our economies. if we focus just for a moment on the second point around agriculture, the biggest single driver of spillovers has to do with the transformation of ecosystem, land use change. The biggest single driver of land use change is livestock production. 75%, and in particular, cattle production and the associated crop production to feed livestock. And so one of the enormous challenges we have is to revisit how we access our protein needs. A serious discussion that as we think about the expanding population in the 21st century, particularly since most of that is going to come from sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, the challenge we have is that if the dietary patterns, which have been the dominant patterns of the last century, where animal protein, in particular beef protein, has a large percentage of that animal protein consumption, we're going to really accelerate exponentially the spillover risks that we are facing. As a society, we need to take a step back and ask ourselves, are there alternate, smarter ways of meeting our protein needs? Are there smarter ways of consuming and producing animals? And we need to really seriously think about that as a global community.
Do we have to get used to live with the danger of new pandemics in the future?
Well, we don't have to get used to the dangers of new pandemics, only in as much as they're a direct consequence of how we live on this planet. And we can change how we live on this planet. And it's not just the need to change how we live on this planet to prevent future pandemic risk. When you look at issues around climate change, the single biggest predictor of where climate change is playing itself out also is associated with land use change. So we don't have to get used to the idea of spillover accelerating, nor do we have to get used to the idea of climate change. They're not inevitable. As a global community, we've had ample discussions about what are the things that need to be done. What we haven't had is the political will and the political leadership to make those things that need to be done, done.
And one last question, going back to the earlier warnings of pandemics that have been spread for years, but many people have not been listening to it, and now they are starting to listen. Are you frustrated about it?
It's safe to say that over the last 20 years, we've had a whole series of events which have mobilized the global community, mostly out of fear. We had SARS in 2002. We had the avian influenza in 2005, the H1N1 pandemic of 2009, then Ebola in 2014. Each time there has been this surge in attention to address these problems. And once those problems fade and are essentially off the front pages of the news media, people's attention drift away and the funding that had been available is no longer available. So the concern is that even as the global community is fully attentive now to the threat of the COVID-19, we've seen a steady pattern over the last several decades that once a threat is gone, quite literally, it's forgotten. Each of these events is a teaching moment. We can get smarter, but that requires that we have political will and leadership and investment that sustain our ability to build on those lessons, not during the time of the viral wars, if you will, but during the time of the peace, the period between viral outbreaks. That's when we need to make sure we stay focused. We've not seen good behavior, if you will, in the past. Maybe this is enough of a shock to people, but we also have to prepare for the fact that people will no longer be interested in this once it's over.
Dr. Carroll, thanks a lot for your time.
Well, thank you, Peter.